From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. During election years, we can see how grueling the campaign trail is on candidates, but we don't see the strain it puts on the candidate's spouse. Joy Shuck was the wife of a candidate, and on this edition of Fresh Air, she talks about her experience and the experiences of others. Also today, best-selling mystery writer Sue Grafton talks with us about her latest work, H is for Homicide. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Gold Star Studios, where Phil Spector made music history. That and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The wife of a Briton held hostage in Lebanon said today that British embassy officials have told her that two Western hostages will be released within 24 hours. Sunny Mann said the British consul and the British ambassador in Beirut told her that the hostages to be released were American Terry Anderson and Briton John McCarthy. She said that she was told that her husband, Jackie Mann, would not be released. The report, aired on British television, is the latest in a series of stories saying that a hostage release is imminent. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar was to have made a statement on the issue in the past hour, but minutes ago he announced that he would have nothing to say. Kurdish officials say that 29 Kurdish civilians have been killed and several dozen were injured this week when Turkish planes staged bombing runs inside Iraq. NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Istanbul.
Officials for the Kurdish Democratic Party, one of two main Kurdish political parties in northern Iraq, say that Turkish warplanes attacked two refugee settlements inside Iraq near the border with Turkey. 18 people were killed on Monday, the officials say, and 11 in new attacks today. In a statement, the party condemned the attacks and called upon allied forces now in southern Turkey to intervene to protect the Kurds. This is the first report of civilian casualties in the operation. Turkish officials say that tanks, warplanes, and 20,000 troops crossed the border into Iraq this week in pursuit of PKK guerrillas who are fighting a secessionist struggle against the Turkish government. The Turks have now declared a three-mile-wide free fire zone along Iraq's border. I'm Deborah Wong reporting.
Israel said today it's willing to trade Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners for missing Israeli servicemen. Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The Israeli statement came as expectation increased that the radical Islamic Jihad group might free two Western hostages. Israel has seven missing servicemen captured in South Lebanon between 1982 and 1986. Israeli officials today reiterated Israel's position that they are willing to trade Lebanese and Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails for their missing soldiers. Israel's most prominent prisoner is Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid, a Shiite Muslim cleric kidnapped in Lebanon 3 years ago. Israel said it took Sheikh Obeid as a bargaining chip to get its soldiers back. Israeli analysts say the expected release of the two Western hostages is likely to be the first step of a package deal involving both the Westerners and the Israelis. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today after a rally failed to push the Dow to a new record, despite signs that interest rates will be coming down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished unchanged, closing at 3,026.6. Advances edged declines in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 171 million shares. This is NPR. The Pentagon said today that it is not planning to change its policy banning homosexuals from the military. The statement came in a letter from the Defense Department's legal chief to 32 U.S. House members who asked that the ban be lifted. The House members were acting on a military document obtained by Massachusetts Democrat Jerry Studs. The document laid out a policy basis for ending the ban on gay men and lesbians in the military. The Pentagon's legal policy chief, Captain T.D. Keating, said that the Defense Department has no plans to lift the ban. The policy statement comes shortly after Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said that he believes homosexuals should be allowed to hold civilian jobs at the Pentagon. West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller has announced that he will not seek the Democratic presidential nomination in 1992. Chuck Anzalewicz of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Speaking to well-wishers in Charleston, Senator Rockefeller said that he had only been considering a run for the Oval Office since May. and that 3 months just wasn't enough time to plan a Rockefeller administration. But Rockefeller, who chairs the Pepper Commission and the National Commission on Children, says that if anything, his short-lived campaign has hurt the Bush administration's credibility on domestic issues.
With forcing the American agenda, so to speak, into the Rose Garden and making George Bush be accountable to it. He's not yet, but he's going to have a lot to be accountable to.
Rockefeller did not rule out the possibility of a presidential bid in 1996 or later. For National Public Radio, I'm Chuck Anzalevich in Charleston, West Virginia.
Israel's housing ministry confirmed today that it's building 1,500 new homes in the Golan Heights, part of the territory that's expected to be disputed at the upcoming Mideast Peace Conference. A ministry spokesman said that the project is part of a plan to build 3,000 new homes in the area by 1992 and double the Jewish population there. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. My guest, Joy Shuck, had a rewarding career working as a counselor with single parents and troubled youth when in 1985 her husband decided to run for governor of Colorado. Shuck was expected to give up her career and become a political wife. That meant spending 18 hours a day on the campaign trail, making speeches and attending events on behalf of her husband. Toward the end of the campaign, she found herself feeling exhausted and depressed. She wrote in her journal, "I can almost feel my personal identity slipping away." After her husband's defeat in the primary, Joy Shuck began talking to other political wives, including Barbara Bush and Marilyn Quayle. She's now written a book called Political Wives, Veiled Lives. When her husband first told her in 1985 that he wanted to run for governor, Joy Shuck didn't really understand what she was getting herself into.
Well, I really just imagined that it would not be very different than what I was already doing, which was pretty much leading a very independent life. And I thought I would be making speeches, which, you know, at first is rather frightening. But once you do a few, you get really comfortable with it and enjoyed it very much. But I just imagined that it would be not too different a lifestyle than we already had. And I was very surprised. I was very wrong.
You were given a booklet. I believe it was called The Candidate's Wife. And this was a set of instructions, I guess, about the etiquette of campaigning.
Yes.
Can you instruct us in what that book instructed you?
Well, I found it, among other things. I really thought it was something that was more like a parody. I just could not believe that this was what was supposed to be reality for the political wife, and that was that you were to really and truly and totally subordinate yourself. In fact, when I started reading it, you know, it would say, well, if you don't have an answer to this or that question, it's perfectly all right and advisable for you to just sit back and tell everybody that you'd have to go home and discuss it with your husband. And, you know, I mean, things like that, I just really had a problem with that because it only reminded me of Pat Nixon, you know, the quintessential political wife, you know, who in fact in 1975 said, "I have sacrificed everything in my life I considered precious in order to advance the political career of my husband." And so I didn't see myself in that role. And so when I was reading this little handbook on how to be supportive and smile at your husband's workers, and I mean, it was just demeaning.
Who wrote this handbook?
I don't know. It was, there was no author, but it was put out by the Republican National Committee, and I don't know what year, but it seemed to me it was very, very old.
You write about what the quote-unquote system demands of a political wife, I guess the system as you read in this particular book. When you talk about the system, who or what is, who's the architect of that? Who is perpetuating this?
Well, you know, that's a good question. It's a complicated question. The system, for me, is everything that comprises politics. It is expected of you, whether it is by the campaign staff, whether it is by a media consultant, whether it is by a just people in the political realm who decide what the role should be. And the first thing, of course, as this manual also indicated, was image. And that is, you know, to me, not where we should be going. We need more authenticity in politics.
What problem do they have with a strong-willed, opinionated wife?
Well, and the one thing that I learned was that a strong, opinionated wife is supposed to shout with confidence her strength of character, her opinions, her statements, but with her mouth closed. So you're really discounted as a person, Barbara Bush said, when George is no longer in public office, we can go to parties and we can fight and we can have a good time, but right now we're a united front. And that's what is expected for the wife to be in total agreement with her husband. One political wife, who I know very well and interviewed, said to me, you have to be so careful what you say because tomorrow you may find your words in the newspaper, and I have. And she said she knew of another particular person with whom I also interviewed. And this woman said to me, when she was new to politics, she went to a party, she talked with a reporter, she was having a very nice conversation. She really didn't understand at the time that what you say is on the record unless you indicate that this is off the record. And so the reporter asked the woman how she felt about her husband's position on such and such, and she disagreed with him. And so she told her, and she told her what her position was. Unfortunately, the next day, the headline said, political couple bickering. And that, of course, is why so many political wives are very closed. They're very cautious. They don't want their words to come back and bite them or destroy their husband's career because they believe differently than he does. And it's unfortunate.
I'm speaking today with Joy Shuck, and she's the author of a book called Political Wives, Veiled Lives. Why do people agree to this grueling 18-hour schedule of dinners and handshakes and meeting people in front of factories and giving speeches? Why agree to that?
Well, I agree with you. I don't think that one has to do that. I think you have to set limits. You have to take responsibility. A woman really has to take responsibility for herself. There's maybe a way of explaining, how, and this may make it a little easier to understand. I believe a lot of the problem with women who are political spouses stems from a generational issue. We have the women of the pre-50s, let's say, and then Barbara Bush fits in that area. And so these women were raised in traditional households, raised to be a wife and mother, to stay home. And even when the children are grown and gone, she is also expected to stay at home. Now, of course, she does volunteer work or whatever her causes or interests are. That's not to say she doesn't do those, but she really is more of a homebody. The women of the 50s really are the ones, I believe, who have the most difficult time because these women also were raised in traditional households, but they then have the influence of the women's movement, which many of these women have, you know, a lot of the ideas of the women's movement have been embraced by these women. And so I refer to them more like the swing generation. You know, they swing back and forth. Now we get to the women of the post-60s. Now, these are the women who do have a career, who fit the modern woman image that the public's expectations pretty much describe. And these are the women who can impact the system because they don't necessarily comply with all these rules. And they're the ones who are setting good limits for themselves. They will go here, they won't go there. They They say things like, it was his victory. I was a major part of it, but it was his victory. So there's really a difference when you look at the generations.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Joyce Shuck, and her new book, Political Wives, Veiled Lives, examines the travails the wife of a political candidate faces when her husband runs for office. It's an experience that Shuck knows firsthand. In 1986, her husband lost his bid to be elected governor of Colorado. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joyce Shuck, and her book is called Political Wives, Veiled Lives. How much damage do you think a political wife can do to her husband's campaign? I'm thinking, for instance, of Kitty Dukakis, who almost before the press could get a hold of the story, went public and told everyone about her addiction problems. I don't think that was seen as necessarily hurtful to her husband's campaign. But do you see instances where a woman really can do political damage?
Well, I've been told by several political wives that you have to be very careful what you say because you can damage his chances. You can damage his image, and in turn, it damages your image. But Betty Ford was interesting because she was the kind of woman who had internalized a lot of the image portion of politics. She had subordinated herself, although she was very candid and open about a lot of issues. And she said, I went along for a long time thinking everything was okay. I was married to the perfect husband. I had four perfect children. I lived in this wonderful home. And I didn't understand what the therapists were talking about when they suggested that I had problems. You see, and so much of what the expectations are, if a woman buys into them and tries to live that way so that she won't say what will in any way, shape, or form harm her husband's chances, she's going to have consequences.
Do you see these women then as real casualties of the political process?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. It's very sad. It really is. It isn't the way it has to be, I don't believe.
You describe the trials and tribulations of being a campaign wife, but there are many perks, I would think. I mean, there's just plain attention. There's the spotlight. There's the applause. Did you enjoy that?
Well, as I say, you can get caught up in it, but given my druthers would not be to be in the limelight. I also would prefer that politics was not, and politicians were not given star status. You know, to me, I grew up thinking that politicians ran for office because they wanted to serve their country, not because they were celebrities. And so I have a different view of what I would like to see politics, you know, the direction I would like to see politics go.
Did your husband sense the strain you were under? The way you wrote, you hardly saw each other, so I can't imagine it would be hard for him to see how you were struggling with his campaign.
Oh, yes. We talked about it a lot. We really did. And I think one of my journal entries, I'm not sure, you know, just where I included it, but I know that we had discussed often that I was feeling as if my identity was starting to erode and I was having problems and I was not really going to graciously relinquish parts of myself. And I can remember him saying to me one time, well, my gosh, I thought we had this this wonderful marriage going now because we're working as a team.
Well, that gets back to what you said about the kind of pressure to be perfect, I guess, to present this united front, to look like this family that would have walked off the pages of the Saturday Evening Post.
Yeah, how ludicrous. I mean, you know, when you think about Elizabeth Taylor, somebody who was so independent and free-spirited and intelligent, and even she tried to be and live by a prescribed role. She, one story, whether it's an exaggeration or not, really does illustrate this prescribed role. When John Warner was running for Senate from Virginia in 1976 for the 78 election, he decided to portray the Virginia farmer. And he was married to Elizabeth Taylor at the time, and he explained to her, you're going to have to kiss a lot of babies, and you're going to shake a lot of hands, and you're going to go to picnics and barbecues and fairgrounds and give speeches and be at my side. However, I would like you to do this and portray yourself as the farmer's wife.
The role of a lifetime, right?
Right, right. The Oscar winning. Another Oscar. But even she, you know, had such a difficult time. The marriage disintegrated. They spent less and less time together. She was shuffled aside, so to speak.
I'm wondering if you felt this way about campaigning, how would you have felt if your husband had actually won?
Yes.
I mean, are you almost relieved that he didn't?
Well, you know, you go through all kinds of emotions after a losing campaign. And one of the emotions is relief, you know. We now can go back to being private people. We don't have to see our lives chronicled in the newspapers. We don't have to be perfect and all the rest of the stuff. But it is a loss. And whether you liked it or not, there's a grieving period. And there's just that a lot of that open space, that sadness that you have to deal with. And a lot of the after effects of a campaign are placed on the wife because he can go back to work the next day. He can go back to his career, whatever that is. And she pretty much helps with tearing down, you know, the whole state, all the headquarters. And she has a more chance to grieve the situation than he does. So loss really is harder for the wife, I think.
Are you talking about yourself?
Yes. Yes. It was hard. You know, not that I loved campaigning all the time, not that I would choose it, but yes, it's a grieving period. Yeah, hard.
If you could do it all over again and turn back the clock and make it 5 years ago, how would you do it differently?
Well, I certainly would not stop working. I would continue doing what I was doing, and I would negotiate much more clearly now. I know more who I am and what my needs are and what is comfortable for me and what isn't. And so I would pick and choose, and I would go to the things that I wanted to go to first and foremost, and I would go to some that my husband felt was critical for me to be there with him because he wanted me there. And then we'd see how it went. But it would be a much different campaign as far as my participation.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Marty.
Joyce Shuck's book about her experiences on the campaign trail is called Political Wives, Veiled Lives. Her husband ran unsuccessfully for governor of Colorado in the mid-1980s. This Friday, CBS premieres its newest summer series, the latest in a growing number of reality programs. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
CBS has done some fun things this summer, like Northern Exposure and Morton and Hayes, but all of that goodwill is spoiled by this.
Fantastic Facts from Time Life's extensive library. Tonight on Fantastic Facts, the forces of nature. It's a fact that once every 18 years, this tidal wave reverses its course and wipes out everything in its path.
About 10 years ago, CBS did a TV version of People magazine, which is the last time I can remember a network taking a publication that dumb and turning it into a TV series that's even dumber. Fantastic Facts is based on Time Life's book series, The Library of Curious and Unusual Facts, and it's a strong contender for Worst Program of the Year. Every aspect of it is awful, including its star.
And now, the host of Fantastic Facts, Merlin Olsen.
This is the warehouse of life.
This is the warehouse of slow death. Merlin Olsen sounds like he's auditioning for a Bartles and James commercial. Then again, if I had to read some of his lines, I'd probably have a hard time generating enthusiasm, too.
Hollywood's version of a twister was movie magic. In The Wizard of Oz, it was all a dream for Dorothy. But in real life, tornadoes are a nightmare of destruction.
Clearly, Fantastic Facts is aimed at idiots. Sentences are short, concepts are simple, and stories are brief. So brief that any piece on Fantastic Facts could fit neatly into any local news show. Not since USA Today, the television show, has any program done so many things so badly so quickly. Fantastic Facts ought to be called not-so-fantastic factoids. Here's a report on bad weather, which ends with a guy being blown off his feet. This is not a clip, mind you. It's the whole report.
It's hard to believe that you can find the world's worst weather just 2 hours outside of Boston, on New Hampshire's Mount Washington. Combining 250 inches of annual snowfall with recorded temperatures as low as 47 degrees below zero, a wind chill factor plunging to an incredible 150 below. The 6,000-foot peak lies near the exact center of three storm paths where colliding fronts produced the fiercest winds ever clocked on Earth, an astonishing 231 miles an hour.
Oof, with weather like that, it's nice to be inside.
Oof, with television like that, it's better to be outside. Look, I know reality programming is cheaper than sitcoms or dramas. I know it's summer when the networks will try almost anything. And I know taking paragraphs from a simplistic book is a lot easier than actually writing a script. But this kind of programming isn't worthy of a low-rent UHF independent station, much less a so-called major network. This show reeks.
George Washington, the father of our country. Thomas Jefferson, he wrote the Constitution. Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator. And of course, Sylvan Goldman. Oh, he invented the shopping cart. Try to imagine life without it.
I've seen infomercials with more entertainment value than this. And if Fantastic Facts is supposed to be an infomercial for Time Life books or for the future of network television, I've got news for you. I'm not buying.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moskowain with Fresh Air. Sue Grafton has created an alphabet of murder, treachery, and suspense. She's the author of what her fans call the Alphabet series of detective novels, 8 of them so far, beginning with A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, and running through H is for Homicide, all starring female detective Kinsey Millhone. Coming up, Sue Grafton on Thinking About Murder. When record producer Phil Spector created his now famous Wall of Sound, he did it within the walls of the Gold Star recording studio. Coming up, Ed Ward profiles the place where some of rock and roll's greatest hits were made. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that there is now more optimism that some Western hostages held in Lebanon might be released, but that he has no definite information. Mr. Bush told reporters in Maine, where he is on a month-long vacation, that there are a number of reports from a lot of capitals, but he does not want to raise false hopes. In New York City, UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar said today that he is ready to meet anywhere, at any time, with any envoy of a group holding Western hostages. Final discussions are being held by the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council on 2 tough measures to tighten UN control over Iraq. Linda Fasulo reports from New York.
The United States, Britain, France, China, and the Soviet Union are close to an agreement on new measures which will tighten UN controls over Iraq's future weapons program, oil exports, and food distribution to civilians. Earlier today, the full council met in closed session, and Western diplomats say the United States agreed that 30% of the revenue from an Iraqi oil sale would be set aside to compensate Kuwait and other nations for damages during the Persian Gulf War. The United States originally wanted 50% of Iraq's oil revenues to go for reparations. The new draft resolutions are to be presented to the 10 other council members tomorrow, but a vote isn't expected until next week. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
2 officials of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue have left Wichita, Kansas, after a series of protests. But one of the leaders says that demonstrations against 3 city clinics will continue. Gordon Basham of member station KMUW in Wichita reports.
Operation Rescue founder Randall Terry and National Director Keith Tusey left Wichita today, but say they'll return in a few days. Another leader of the movement, Pat Mahoney, denies Terry and Tusey left town because a federal judge ordered them to sign a $100,000 bond. That bond would ensure Dr. George Tiller, who owns one of the women's clinics, is protected against financial damage caused by Operation Rescue. Mahoney says he'll stay in Wichita at least until August 25th, when Operation Rescue plans a big rally. Governor Joan Finney was to have addressed the rally, but now says she's decided not to. Meanwhile, Mahoney says the national organization will phase out its involvement and turn over the demonstrations to the local movement by the 25th of August. For National Public Radio, I'm Gordon Basham in Wichita.
In New Orleans, a federal judge has ruled that Louisiana's new anti-abortion law is not constitutional. The state's abortion law is considered to be the toughest in the nation, and the ruling is almost certain to be appealed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point to close at 3,026. This is NPR News. A coalition of civil rights groups has announced its opposition to the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court. A spokesman for the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights said today that Judge Thomas has not shown a commitment to equal opportunity and equal justice under the law. The group said that Judge Thomas had allowed personal opinions to interfere with his duties to enforce civil rights laws. Paterson, New Jersey, is now the 2nd school district in the nation to be taken over by a state. And as Gene Dillard reports from Trenton, New Jersey's State Board of Education gave formal approval to the takeover today.
3 years ago, Jersey City became the nation's first state-operated school district as New Jersey officials moved in to end a pattern of corruption extending back several decades. Now the state is taking similar action in Paterson. But Education Commissioner John Ellis says the problem in that district is not corruption, but a tragic record of ineptitude.
Enough is enough. our children are too precious, and their education is too critical to stand by and watch year after year inept administration, bad policies, poor performance.
The state-operated Patterson District will be headed by Boston's former superintendent following the ouster of the district's school board and several of its former top officials. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
In West Palm Beach, Florida, a judge has set a trial date of January 13th for William Kennedy Smith, charged with raping a woman last March. Prosecutors had called for a trial to begin October 2nd at the latest. Defense attorneys had requested either a 90-day trial delay because of publicity surrounding the case or a change of venue. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved lower against other foreign currencies. Gold prices were also down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Nearly 10 years ago, readers of crime fiction met Kinsey Milhone this way. I'm a private investigator licensed by the state of California. I'm 32 years old, twice divorced, no kids. The day before yesterday, I killed someone, and the fact weighs heavily on my mind. Milhone was created by writer Sue Grafton. Since then, readers have followed Milhone's exploits through a series of novels based on the alphabet, beginning with A is for Alibi. Her latest novel is H is for Homicide. Kinsey Milhone is part of a growing breed of fictional female private eyes that have become very popular in a world formerly inhabited solely by men. I asked Grafton if she got into crime fiction as a way of challenging that world.
I was raised on hard-boiled private eye fiction. Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, Ross MacDonald, and some of the other male mystery writers like John D. MacDonald, Michelle Scott, Mickey Spillane. So when it came time to try my hand at the mystery, that was the form to which I gravitated. I felt so unqualified to do that kind of writing. I had to take 5 years to teach myself many of the basics. So when it came to designing the prime character, I thought, there is no way I'm going to make him male, because my ignorance was too profound. I thought, well, the one area in which I'm an expert is being female, so by golly, she's going to be female. And now it looks like I had, you know, did it with great calculation, but it's not true. It's pure self-defense.
You talk about the people that you read, I assume, as you were growing up. What brought you back to this kind of writing? Because I'll say for myself, I'm new to this. I didn't grow up reading this kind of... I was probably reading more the Nancy Drew while
yes,
you were reading Mickey Spillane.
Right. Well, I love the mystery novel. For starters, there is always a strong story. It's carefully structured with beginning, middle, and end. Usually from page one, you're off and running. Mm-hmm. I find it's a little difficult sometimes to read mainstream fiction, which is sometimes very out of focus. I'll be reading and I think, well, where is the muscle to this story? So I think particularly now, when the reading public is so accustomed to the fast pace of television, there are many people who don't have that much time to read, and the mystery is a very nice sort of addiction.
And you choose your words then with this muscle that you're talking about?
I write with economy where possible, which is one of the things I learned writing in television. I learned how to do dialogue, I learned how to structure a story, and I learned how to get into a scene and get out of it. Mystery readers, I don't think, are interested in the long, tedious history of the world. They want to know what's going on, and they want to know it fast. So you learn to do that in fairly swift terms. It is disconcerting for people who are used to much more dense fiction to come to the mystery because it's so quick.
Who do you think Kinsey Milhone would be if she was written by a man?
Oh.
What parts of her do you think would be accentuated, desensuated?
Oh,
would she even look differently?
Possibly. I'm not sure how she looks since I tell these in a first-person narrative. We know certain things about her, but often I think people see her differently. Mm. I wonder if a male mystery writer would not emphasize her sexuality, for starters.
But she's sexy.
Yes, she is. But what I've observed is that male mystery writers are interested in demonstrating that their detective is desirable to women. female writers want to demonstrate the competence of our main character, because I think that's what we're talking about. A woman who is a professional, she's competent, she's capable, and that's how she earns a living. So I personally don't talk much about her love life, except, of course, in Gia's for Gumshoe. But I really want to talk about the fact that she's out on those mean streets like the guys are.
Well, do you see her then as a kind of a feminist model for women? Is there something didactic here? And
I hope not. I have never taken a hardline feminist point of view, because to me that's propaganda. I'm interested in telling stories, and I would never distort the direction of a story in order to score political points. So I am somewhat at odds with some of the other mystery writers, because I'm not interested in being politically correct. For instance, there is sometimes objection to women being victims, and I try to be careful about that. I am not interested in promoting the notion of women as victims. But when you're laying out 26 storylines, certain percentage of the time, women will be victims.
I read that this character, Kinsey Millhone, came from a fantasy you had about murdering an ex-husband of yours, and you were apparently in a long-lasting, protracted custody fight.
Yes.
Can you expand on that provocative idea?
Oh, yes. Well, one of my theories about women is that we are not taught how to fight, and certainly when I was going through this very bitter, acrimonious divorce, I didn't have the faintest idea how to defend myself. As a result of that, because of my frustration, I would lie there thinking, is there no way to get this man out of my life? And in the dark of night, little schemes would come to me. Since I am myself such a law-abiding little bun, I knew I'd never get away with it. I just am not that kind. You know, I can tell fibs with the best of them, but breaking the law is just not in my nature.
Well, what did you have in mind for this ex-husband of yours?
Well, that became the plot of A is for Alibi. So what I came up with was the notion of the oleander, which is very common in California, and using that as a means of poisoning somebody.
Mystery writer Sue Grafton is my guest. Her newest Kinsey Millhone novel is called H is for Homicide. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Mystery writer Sue Grafton is my guest. Both your parents were alcoholics.
Yes.
And what are some of your memories of growing up in an alcoholic household?
Well, I remember suffering a lot at the time, and I have done a lot of work to deal with that grief and that rage, so that now I've kind of come out on the other side, and I look back at it as a gift.
Really?
I see it was the perfect life for a writer. As odd as that sounds, I was raised with a great deal of freedom. Because my mother drank, she did not function like a normal parent. So I had a lot of freedom. In our family, we did a lot of reading, and there was not television, because I'm a very old person. We played. There was 10 kids in our neighborhood, and so I spent a lot of time outside of the house because I didn't want to deal with her.
Nor, I would think, would you want to bring your friends
into
the house.
That's right. That's exactly right. There were many humiliations, and I have learned to view her with a great deal of compassion, but it took me a while. And a lot of that I worked out at the machine. I did it through writing. My father was a different sort of alcoholic. He did function. He would start his day with two jiggers of whiskey, but he practiced law. He went into court often with a snootful under his belt, as he used to say. Once she died, he sort of took over the function of full-blown alcoholic and married somebody who then got into codependent behavior with him. But it certainly taught me from an early age everything there is to know about human behavior. The children of alcoholics tend to be very observant because we are always gauging where we are in relationship to the world. So I can't think of a better way to learn how to be connected to the world, how to be disconnected, all those things.
You have described yourself as the mascot in the family,
yes.
And that's really the language of addiction, talking about a kind of family system and how it functions. I assume the mascot is the cheerleader for the family.
Oh, I'm a spiritual cheerleader. I do that to this day. And actually, I fill the other function, too, which is what the one they call the hero, the achiever who goes out in the world. So I sort of filled both slots. I have a sister who's older than I, and I think she suffered more. She came through first, and she took the brunt of it. I kind of tap danced my way through behind her, and I learned to maneuver out of the line of fire. They were not abusive people. I was never hit, and they cared for me as well as they could. So I did not come from a background of depravity or poverty. They were intellectual people. They were people who cared about the world. They just cared about early times and old crow. And so I still have trouble with that. If I'm around somebody who smells of bourbon, I start backing up.
One thing I find interesting is that you killed off Kinsey, this is your character's parents, when she was 5 years old. And just the way this whole idea grew out of this revenge fantasy on your part against an ex-husband, I was wondering if you're trying to get revenge on your parents somehow.
In a way, that was a very deliberate choice on my part. I thought, I'm not going to write about Kinsey Milhone with a lovey, happy mommy-hubby trip at home. So I sort of nuked them early on, and truly there was a little piece of me going, let's just get this out of the way, because I don't have a way to portray happy family life. It always rings slightly false to me. And that's why at one point Kinsey says, you talk about dysfunctional families, I've never seen any other kind.
So you've never seen a happy family?
I have seen an occasional happy family. They are like aliens to me, and I observe them with great curiosity.
Not skepticism?
No, you see a truly happy family, they are a pleasure. One of the things I say, though, when I give talks is, what seems true to me is that nobody from a happy family ever amounts to much in this world. It is those of us who are driven out of childhood by unhappiness that I think we go out in the world and do things to make it better.
There's an organization called Sisters in Crime, founded by Sarah Paretsky. Are you a member? Is this?
No, I've been one of the lone holdouts, in part because I don't believe what they believe. I am too much of a renegade and too much of a rebel, but I don't see women as victims.
And they do?
I think they have seen women mystery writers as people who need special consideration. And certainly at the time that organization was formed, one of the things they were doing was keeping track of how many women were reviewed. And truly the numbers were skewed. I grant them that. But I have always tended to believe in the strength of the individual instead of the mass of humanity. And that's a difference in style. I think they have done some good things in this world, and certainly their intentions are wonderful. I personally am happier working off a different set of precepts, and so I've kept my distance.
I'm wondering how you got yourself into this whole alphabet habit for your titles, and if you regret that at all.
I lie awake at night wondering why I did such a thing to myself. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
The latest one, can I give the title away? Is that
sure.
Okay? It's I is for Innocent.
Yes. Always reserve the right. If I get to the end of the book and it has nothing to do with innocence, I'll make it I is for Iniquity or something else. But the working title is I is for Innocent.
And can you tell us anything about what's happening?
I'd prefer not, because sometimes I surprise myself. I've been known to take off in one direction, junk it, start again, and so I'm a little careful about talking about works in progress.
Writer Sue Grafton. H is for Homicide is the latest in Grafton's series of detective novels featuring Kinsey Milhone. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the stories coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda. I understand that All Things Considered is going to the beach today.
We went to the beach to try to find out, Marty, about young love and young people in these days of date rape and sexually transmitted disease. And what we found out was amazing and charming and a little bit shocking. Art Silverman has made a wonderful piece out of this with music and all sorts of things mixed into it. Really try to hear it. We also have news on the program, the Wichita Abortion Clinic, more on that story. The United Nations has sent an envoy to Damascus in anticipation of the possibility that a hostage may come out.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are a few legendary studios in the world of rock and roll. Bell Sound in New York, United Sound, where Motown got started in Detroit, the Sun Studios in Memphis, and Chess in Chicago, whose address, 2520 South Michigan Avenue, became the title of a Rolling Stones song. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says few of these studios have seen the diversity of talent pass through their doors as did Gold Star. It was cheap, centrally located in Hollywood, and unlike major studios, anyone could use it.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
I'll never forget how disappointed I was when I first saw it, a sort of grimy, beige-ish stucco facade with a door in the middle of it, over which were affixed metallic letters saying Gold Star Recording Studios, Incorporated. On the other hand, I never went inside. And anyway, what was I expecting? In the summer of 1958, two brilliant teenagers recorded two radically different songs at Gold Star that became the biggest hits of that season. Eddie Cochran used their high-tech board to record all of the instruments on Summertime Blues himself, a pretty remarkable achievement for a kid his age. But the true technical whiz was the student from Fairfax High who came in with two friends and also used the technique of overdubbing to record To Know Him Is to Love Him. The kid who'd written the song was 17 years old and deadly serious. He was even incapable of mugging convincingly for his group, the Teddy Bears, album cover. In fact, young Philip Spector had taken the song title from his father's tombstone. But he would make Gold Star the most famous studio in Los Angeles in just a few years. Heaven knows, in 1958, there were enough recording studios in L.A. Gold Star itself had been around since 1950, when it had been founded by Dave Gold and Stan Ross, who jammed their two names together to give the studio a name. Mostly, Gold Star was used for demos, cheap sessions with a minimal band, and the aim of letting a prospective client hear what a songwriter thought a song should sound like. But there was something about the sound at Gold Star, I guess, because with the Teddy Bears and Eddie Cochran riding the charts that summer, a local entrepreneur came in with his big talent discovery to cut another of the year's major hits. Gold Star, though, was the sort of place where you got started as far as Hollywood was concerned. Once you were established, you went on to more high-tech productions and bigger studios. But 4 years after he'd made a hit there, Phil Spector was trying to establish himself in New York as the greatest producer of the age, a 21-year-old genius. He'd had some success working for other people, but now he had his own label, Phillies, and he was going to succeed on his own terms. After a couple of tries with a girl group he'd discovered, the Crystals, he was on his way, but complete success eluded him. So he got on a plane, flew to L.A. from New York, grabbed a group of studio singers, the Blossoms, rented Gold Star, and made another record. He put it out as a Crystals record. What, you thought Milli Vanilli was a new idea? And got his first number one, the first in a long string of them, many recorded at Gold Star. Another major Hollywood figure also got started at Gold Star in 1962, the year of He's a Rebel. Herb Alpert had worked with Bob Keane, who'd discovered Ritchie Valens, and he'd also produced Jan and Dean's first session. When he decided to make a solo record, The Lonely Bull, he did it at Gold Star. It launched A&M Records, which is still a big company today. There were more hits. The In Crowd by Dobie Gray in 1965, I Got You Babe by Sonny and Cher, and even Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys, all from that grungy building at Santa Monica and Vine. Gold Star closed in 1983, and today its site is a mini mall. Too bad. There was magic in that room. Somebody should at least have bottled some before they tore it down.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He writes for the Austin Chronicle. Our research assistant is Ellen Silva, with additional help today from Gary Dreyfuss. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Yes, you got my eye. Yes, my own mind. And when you walk me home, they do run, 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 they do run, run.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Richard Stallman's been called the best computer programmer in the entire world. It's a talent that could probably make him a million working for some big software company. But Stallman believes computer programs are for sharing, not for big profits. We'll talk with Richard Stallman on the next edition of Fresh Air.